Welcome to another ABC Radio National podcast. For more information, go to abc.net.au/rn.
Good morning, Ramona Koval with you for The Book Show on ABC Radio National. Today, the digital future of books. Digital music is more or less killing the music publishers, but some think that e-books will save the book. How are e-books transforming the way publishers and readers and writers go about their business? We'll find out shortly. And later we'll hear the final in our first person reading this week of Life Class, The Education of a Biographer by Brenda Nile. So first this morning, imagine a Dungeons and Dragons role-playing type game, but instead of pretending to be a knight or a wizard, you're doing it with characters from a funky new novel, say from the Rorschach texts. Or if you're an author, imagine you no longer make money from your book, but from the tie-ins your book produces, maybe a computer game like the one I just described. These scenarios have been hot topics of discussion this week at a seminar about the future of digital publishing, organised by the Australia Council. Publishers and literary agents and authors have been imagining a world of print-on-demand and e-book utopia, and they've been nutting out issues from the more glamorous side of marketing to the fiddly problems of rights management. So it's a good time to ask, what does the future of the book look like? And put aside your belief that the traditional book is best, because our guests this morning have ideas of reinventing the book as a central part of our culture. Joining us on this digital publishing discussion is Mike Schatzkin. He's a leading digital publishing consultant, and he's the inside knowledge of the publishing world. He's in Australia at the moment for this seminar by the Australia Council called Publishing the Story of the Future. And Sherman Young, he's from Macquarie University, and his forthcoming book, The Book is Dead, Long Live the Book, is all about e-book publishing. They're both joining us from Sydney. And Nuri Vitacci, who many of you will know as our regular on our program, he's from the Asia Literary Review. He's a novelist and an avid e-book reader, and he joins us from Hong Kong. Good morning to all of you.
Good morning.
In fact, all of our guests are e-book users, and we want to look at what the future might look like if publishers go down that path of digital publishing and what it means for you as readers and writers. So I know you all read e-books. I'd like to ask you, each of you, how you use them and what you read books on. Mike Schatzkin, what about you?
I read books on my personal digital assistant, which has for the last several years been a Palm Pilot. And I read what I would read in paper. I read the very same books as long as they're available to me in the Palm format.
What about Sherman Young?
I read books on my smartphone, which at the moment is a Palm Treo. But I tend not to read so much books that are published in paper, but things that I can get online that perhaps aren't available on paper. For example, I've just been reading a book which is a draft of a book that a friend has just written. And I'm reading it in the doctor's appointment, in the waiting rooms, any spare moment where I can, you know, spend 5 or 10 minutes, I just whip it out and have a look. The other thing that I do is I have an old thing called a Zion Series 7, which is kind of a big personal digital assistant, probably about the size of a large trade paperback. And when we go on holidays, we load it up with 20 or 30 titles, and my partner and I use that.
Do you fight over it?
No, she wins.
You give up before
the
fight.
Absolutely.
What about you, Nuri? Where do you read it? What do you read on, and where do you read it?
Well, you know, I still have a soft spot for the older paper book, but there are opportunities where only an e-book will do. Yesterday, I was in a very, very boring meeting. I desperately hope no one from that meeting is listening to this, but it was so boring. It lasted 2.5 hours, and I pretended to be checking messages on my I have a large screen phone, but really I was reading a thriller called Ice Hunt about monsters coming from the Arctic and eating people. It was wonderful.
All right. So, and what were you reading it on? Just your personal organizer.
It's a phone with a big screen, which is that phone screens are growing day by day, and I've got one with a large screen that scrolls automatically, so I can sit there in a meeting and a story is scrolling before my eyes.
The implication is that people wouldn't be insulted if you were checking messages, but they would be insulted if you were reading a book.
I think that's true, actually. If you're reading a book, you're in another planet, whereas if you're just checking a message, you're still in the meeting, aren't you?
Isn't that interesting? So there's a whole question of etiquette that goes around a book and reading, which is different. Now, let's talk about what digital publishing is. Now that we know, now you've admitted what you really do in private, what is digital publishing all about? Mike, what does it encompass?
Well, what it really encompasses is the movement of the book from the source, which could be a publisher, could be a retailer, could be just someone who wants to pass it along, as a file rather than as something already printed on paper. Now, once the file is moved, it could be printed on paper to be consumed, but it would still qualify as digital publishing if it traveled from the source to the consumer as a digital file.
It's interesting because these days it travels from the author to the publisher as a digital file. That's an easy thing to do. Nobody sends a TypeScript anymore, really. But it's that extra move, isn't it? It's the extra step that we're talking about. Well, delivering it to the readers.
Well, I guess publishing, as you say, is digital up until the point where the reader gets their hands on it. And so it seems, you know, as a reader and a book lover, it seems a bit strange in 2007 that we can't go that extra step for a lot of books and we still have to get it as an object.
Well, and actually what's really peculiar is that publishers absolutely insist on getting digital files, primarily because they don't want to not only introduce the cost of rekeying the book, they don't want to introduce the error that comes from rekeying the book. So they want to get the file as the author created it. But oddly enough, in the course of turning it into a book, they sometimes confuse the file sufficiently so that it's not so readily passed along to someone else as a digital file.
I think that's happened to lots of people, you know, that terrible mistake that's happened between the publisher and the printer in the past. So I think a lot of authors would be happy about that. But as you've been discussing the future of publishing this week, and before we look at what's happening on the ground, I'd like to know, Mike, in your wildest dreams, what might publishing look like in the future?
Well, I've been having these wild dreams for a long time, and actually I've been predicting the publishing future for about 15 years, and sometimes I get it right and sometimes I get it wrong. And what I really got wrong is 6 or 7 years ago, I would have thought by now that we would be shifting a lot of books as digital files, and we're not. And I would have thought that we would have gotten there because professional use of written material would have shifted to electronic use. So think about something like an aircraft repair manual, which has to be accurate, which has to be changed all the time. It would make so much more sense to have those things be digital for control purposes rather than having to substitute pages in a loose leaf. But those things haven't happened. I think that where we will go in the next 10 or 20 years, however, is that much more will be shifted by digital files, and people will print them and bind them into books when they want to, but they won't necessarily do that.
Why do you think there's been such resistance? I mean, I can make a guess, but you tell me what you think.
I think that really there's resistance in two places. As a matter of fact, earlier you were saying, what will the publishers do? The first problem is, what will the consumers do? And unless the consumers are willing to think about immersive reading on a screen, it's not about reading on a screen. We all read on screens. We read emails, we read articles, we read websites. But somehow or another, immersive reading on a screen has been a little harder for people to adjust to. But there's also been an extraordinarily fragmented marketing effort. You don't, in the world of buying books online, the e-books are not offered right alongside the regular books. And in a market like Australia, where most of the book buying is not online, but in shops, there's no convenient or easy or obvious way to offer the e-book alongside the book. And I think that has a lot to do with it.
But what about that idea? I mean, I imagine that reference book you talked about that needed to be updated all the time, the aircraft thingy. Now, I mean, don't you think there's a bit of resistance in people? They want to have a paper. They want to have something they can hold in their hand because people are afraid that what happens if the computer doesn't work? What happens if the electricity doesn't work? I mean, there is a nervousness about throwing all caution to the wind and thinking everything we all know, we're going to know in the whole universe is going to be on our computers, and that I'm a bit nervous about trusting it and being able to access it.
The one place that apparently that digital books have really happened is for doctors in emergency rooms on personal digital assistants. And the reason for that is because they, first of all, need complete up-to-date information, preferably about the patient as well as about the medicine. And secondly, they can't take a chance on the fact that the book is a year old and new information is developed in the last year and it's not in the book. So, in fact, the more current and the more accurate you need the information to be, the more that should compel you to electronic, not print. So, in fact, I would look at it the other way around from the way you've described it.
Well, Sherman, in your book, The Book is Dead, you suggest that digital publishing will revive the book industry. In what way will it do this?
Well, I guess I'm an optimist at heart, and I look at the costs involved in printing and shipping these often beautiful but inefficient objects around the world, you know, like the Australian publishing industry relies a lot on China to do a lot of its printing. So, you know, you get the artwork typeset and all laid out here in Australia, the file gets shipped to China, the books get shipped back here, shoved in a warehouse somewhere, which is often in a city a long way away from the bookshops, then gets distributed all around Australia. Then the returns come in and the returns go back to the warehouse. Some of them are held, some of them are pulped. There seems to me an awful lot of money tied up in creating objects. And I think, as a book lover, I think that what books are about is not just about printing objects. What books are about is something more important, that their content, their text can contribute to our culture, our social thinking, our conversation, if you like. And my hope, my optimism, is rooted in the fact that if we can divert some of those resources which go towards distributing objects, then perhaps we can spend more time and energy on creating lovely books.
Lovely books and lovely ideas? I mean,
Absolutely, lovely ideas.
What makes you think that saving money on distribution is going to make book publishers want to publish high-end literary things?
Well, it's not necessarily high-end literary things. I don't want to be elitist in that sense. It's more like I'm keen for conversations to happen in a whole range of areas. And I get a sense that, you know, a lot of publishers will say, are not going to publish that book because it's too expensive for the sales we're going to get. Now, the hope is that if you go digital, a lot of those expenses come down. Yes, you still have to do the editing process, you have to lay out the book, etc., but you don't have to print it. So all of a sudden, if a book were only going to sell 1,000 copies, which may or may not be economic in a market like Australia, all of a sudden the economy's changed. Now, they might not change, like, totally, but they may change sufficiently that a book that would only sell 1,000 copies becomes more viable. The flip side of that is that, as Mike suggests, shifting a file is really easy. So if I want to sell that 1,000-copy book to other markets around the world, as an e-book, it's much easier. Now, we'll get into territorial rights later, I assume, but in terms of actually moving the content of the book, if someone in New York says, okay, I really, really want a copy of that book, and the publisher's in Australia, it's a lot easier to just, like, bang, there it is. 30 seconds later, the file's on their computer. So, you know, in that context, the market for an e-book is potentially much more accessible than the market for a physical book.
I want to go to Nuri Vitacci in Hong Kong in a second, but I want to know, Mike, do you agree with this, that the digital publishing will mean ideas will be back at the forefront of the book industry?
Well, I'm not quite sure I'd state it that aggressively, but I would want to make two points. One is the book business is many businesses. It's not a single thing. And what happens with a novel is and the impact of e-publishing on a novel is completely different than, let's say, the impact of e-publishing on a single-volume encyclopedia of gemstones. So I think we need to think about the fact that books are a form that serve a very wide variety of intellectual and entertainment needs, and similarly, e-books will apply differentially But the point that Sherman's making, I think, is inescapable. If you have a cost of publishing a book, and that cost is acquiring it, editing it, putting it into a readable form, and the way the world is at the moment, printing some minimum number of copies, which is probably 1,000, but for many books would be more than 1,000. And that printing cost is larger than all the other costs combined. And then you've got the problem after that of the cost of storing and shipping those books, which is significant. And if you take those costs away, you change the economics extraordinarily, and you make it possible for books which today would not be profitable to be profitable in the future. So whether the increase in availability means that there's going to be a concomitant increase in quality is a separate question, but there certainly would be an increase in diversity.
And access, obviously.
And access.
On ABC Radio National, this is The Book Show. I'm Ramona Koval, and today we're talking digital publishing. And our guests are Mike Schatzkin, who's a digital publishing consultant, Sherman Young, author of The Book Is Dead, which is a forthcoming book, and Nuri Vitacci, who's our regular on the program. Nuri, what's the state of play for digital publishing in your part of the world, in Hong Kong?
I mean, people in Asia tend to be gadget mad, and we tend to be leapfroggers too. We tend to jump ahead. So while hardback book reading hasn't really caught on here, people are going straight to texts, and they're reading texts on unusual things. One of the most popular things to read texts on is Nintendo game consoles. It's a DS Lite, which is really designed for. Well, in Australia, they'd be used by children, but in Asia, they're used a lot by adults. In Japan, they're massive with adults, and people are reading on these things. One problem is that technology still hasn't really, equaled the book. Like, I like to read at the bus stop, and you can't read an e-book at the bus stop because in Asia the sun is too bright, and the contrast level between an e-book and the back screen is not as strong as with a normal book of black print.
So you need a parasol, don't you?
Yes, that's right. A parasol would be a lovely idea.
A little one for the little machine.
Yes. My wife likes to read in the bath, and that's another place you cannot take your e-book. So bath and bus stop are off the list, I'm afraid.
But on the other hand, my wife likes to turn out the light before I'm done reading, and I can continue to read on my Palm Pilot with a dark room. So the fact is that as Sherman was saying, when you're sitting in his example is slightly different, but when you're sitting in somebody's waiting room for an appointment, you're likely to have your personal organizer and your book in your pocket, and you're not likely to be carrying around a heavy hardback. So I think that there are circumstances where, first of all, different devices would work because, for example, the Sony Reader would be readable under a bright light where a Palm Pilot wouldn't. And there are circumstances where paper is preferable, and there are circumstances where e-books are preferable.
So we need both, I think, is what you're saying, Mike, and I'd agree with that.
I'd agree with that, yes.
Yeah, e-books are really a supplementary device to the book as opposed to a replacement device.
Now, Nuri, you also say that the influence of Asia on the internet and internet use will decide the future. Now, what do you mean by that?
Yes, it's quite an easy sum to calculate, but the main language of the internet is very shortly going to be Chinese, and I don't think the rest of the world is kind of ready for this. I believe it was last week, according to most calculations, that the number of internet users from China overtook the number of internet users from the United States. And probably by some time in the middle of next year, Chinese will be the main language of the internet. So it's really it's Asian habits that are going to decide the future in many ways, because by sheer volume of numbers, Asia is already nearly 4 billion people live in Asia, as opposed to 2 billion on the rest of the planet.
So how will Asian book habits, how do they differ from Westerners?
They are much more gadget conscious, gadget using. So in a way, they're playing up to what Mike and Sherman are interested in. They're much more likely to use what Westerners would think of as toys. No Asian would be ashamed. No Asian adult would be ashamed of using a Nintendo DS on his commute to work to read a book. Whereas I think in Western countries, in Australia, probably you wouldn't see so many adults using a little gadget associated with kids, for example.
So, do they acquire the gadget? Do you read books, or are they using the gadget for other things as well?
Speaking as a Nintendo DS Lite user, I actually use mine to play games.
Have you ever thought of using it to download a book onto?
Well, it's not a particularly mature market here, the e-book for Nintendo market. It's much easier to get games. There is a web browser you can get for it, but it's from all reviews, I haven't actually spent the money to get it. It's quite limited. There are a couple of what they like to call interactive fictions, and I have tried.
What are they? You have to sort of supply the end or something to a book.
No, it's kind of like a, you know. I hesitate to use the term like a choose your own adventure, but in a far more sophisticated sense.
Much more sophisticated.
Yeah, absolutely, much more sophisticated. But yeah, there is a narrative, and you follow the narrative, and there are puzzles you do, and the narrative branches depending on what you do. And
so, what about formats in English rather than? I mean, presumably all the formats in Chinese, Nuri, are okay. You can download something onto your Nintendo thingy.
But actually, there's a wonderful one in English that you can get in Australia called Brain Age, and it starts off as a normal physical book, but it's huge. There's something like 8 million copies worldwide now, and it's a little tiny little cartridge, and you stick it into a Nintendo DS, and it's for adults only. And
it's got rude pictures on it.
No.
it's exercises for the brain.
It's actually a very, very confronting title, and I, again, my poor old partner gets dragged into this. You do these quizzes, and it tells you how old your brain is based on how successfully you do these quizzes. So, you know, like there's number games and reading games and stuff, and it's
quite competitive.
How old
is your brain?
Oh, look, I have the brain of a 21-year-old. It's fantastic.
And not just the brain
I wish.
Is that the knowledge level of a 21-year-old?
Yeah, exactly. I'd want the wisdom level of an 80-year-old.
No, they're talking about, you know, the responsiveness, the ability to do mental arithmetic very quickly, those sorts of brain.
I think one thing we should clarify is that just because there's a digital file and just because there's a gadget doesn't mean that that digital file will work on that gadget. And one of the things which, for example, if the PlayStation became the reading device of choice, then publishers, English language publishers who have not configured their books to be read on it would have to make that conversion. And that is actually one of the barriers to ebook take-up, is that there are many devices on which people might read for which ebooks, even if it's available in a Palm format, might not be available to be read on that telephone or on that particular game device. Each of them, you have to configure it to the screen, you have to configure it to the device itself, and that's one of the complications.
But that's going to change, isn't it? Because that's what happened in the early stages of, you know, whether you're an Apple user or a PC user, and all of that was solved eventually, wasn't it?
I'd like to see.
No,
it's not solved.
Well, it's solved for the real world.
Because we all bought PCs.
No, not all of us, but that's a different argument. But I'd like to think it will be solved. But I think what's my spin on it is, I suspect that the standard will emerge out of the marketplace rather than be imposed on it by a standards body. Now, that's a tricky thing to say, because I actually like the idea of a properly configured standard. But the experience of the software industry over the last 20 or 30 years is that that doesn't happen that way.
We just have to think of beta video.
Or even closer to home, like, you know, if you're a website developer, for example, there are clearly articulated, clearly defined standards for building a website. Unfortunately, if you use Internet Explorer on a Windows machine, that browser doesn't comply with the standards. Now, because most people use Internet Explorer, most website developers ignore the standard and develop for IE because it's the de facto standard. Now, there are, I know, lots of attempts to develop some form of standard for ebook reading, and there's a number of bodies that are trying to come up to some sort of consensus. But you've got to think that what's going to happen is if a compelling device emerges in the next 5 years which uses a particular standard, that all of a sudden, you know, millions of people decide that this is the one, then that will, by, you know, dictum of the marketplace, become what ebooks are published in.
Okay. Well, on ABC Radio National, this is The Book Show. I'm Ramona Koval, and we're talking digital publishing with Mike Schatzkin, who's a digital publishing consultant, and Sherman Young, who's an academic and author of the forthcoming The Book Is Dead, and Nuri Vitacci in Hong Kong. Now, Mike, the scenarios I talked about at the beginning with author tie-ins and role-play spin-offs, how likely are they, or are they with us now?
Well, there almost anything you can name is with us now. It's just a question of how much uptake there is. I think that there's a tremendous movement at the moment for authors to promote themselves on the web and to make chunks of books available to people through the web in any variety of ways. And I think that publishers are beginning to wake up to the fact that one of the opportunities of 21st century publishing is that authors' efforts to promote their books can be far more effective than they had ever been able to be before. And the challenge for publishers is first of all to make sure authors are following best practices and are able to do the best things, but also to help authors by stringing them together. If you're publishing a lot of science fiction authors and you link them to each other, they're going to get higher, they're going to score higher on Google. They're going to come up faster on searches because of all the links. Now, the authors can't do that for themselves as well as the publishers could do if they helped them. So I think that these things are already happening, but they're in very, very immature experimental stages, and there's a lot of infrastructure to be developed over the next few years that will make it all more productive.
I must say, Mike, I was completely shocked when I read your paper that you gave to this conference, where you suggested that book publishers or publishers should encourage authors to maybe work for 5 hours a week or up to 10 hours a week promoting their own book on the net. And I thought, yeah, well, that's all good for the publishers because, as you say, they'd save a lot of money. But when are authors supposed to write books if they're sitting on the net communicating with people and playing games with them?
Well, in fact, those numbers were not my numbers. Those numbers came from a survey of literary agents, 65 of them in New York, who said it was their opinion that authors, in order to be commercially successful, should be spending between 2 and 10 hours a week promoting themselves on the Internet.
This is instead of the agents promoting them, presumably.
Well, no, this is maybe not instead of anything. This is because the reading community wants to communicate with the authors. And the reading community, and in fact, many authors write books specifically to engage a community in which they want to have a discussion. And the book is a way of starting the discussion. So there are many authors that look at that 2 to 10 hours not as a chore, but as the opportunity that was unlocked by publishing the book.
And I think, you know, it's probably too easy to draw comparisons with the music industry because a lot of them aren't valid. But you look at what's happening on MySpace and MySpace Music, and I spent the last few months interviewing quite a number of musicians about what they do with things like MySpace. They spend a lot of time there, but it's all part of developing a fan base, communications with other bands. I've had, like, musicians who've told me that because of their MySpace page, they've got gigs in New York. You know, they suddenly find they have fans in Finland, and, you know, they develop a real community around their music. Now, yeah, it is hard work. You know, my blog, www.thebookisdead.com, plug, but, you know, it takes a lot of time to, which I haven't got. So, you know, you often run the risk of having a half-developed
blog. That means you're not going to write another book, are you? You're just going to be playing with
people. Look, it depends on what you do. You know, like, I'm an academic, so, you know, absolutely. You know, I don't have teaching
now, look,
or
I just,
research.
I just wanted to talk to Nuri on this, because, Nuri, you've been approached by a game developer to write a book for a handheld platform. Tell us about that and what it would involve.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, to some extent, I disagree with the comments made earlier that there's going to be a killer device eventually that will set the standard. I think the killer item is going to be a book, a story of some sort that will have everybody, that won't be available on a book, that will only be available electronically, and that will have all the readers queuing up to read it chapter by chapter or volume by volume.
Because it's different from what it would be in a book? Because it's got sound or pictures or what?
Yeah, no, not because it's different, just because it's a great story. Imagine if somebody wrote Harry Potter but wrote it only available as an ebook. Then you'd have to do it. So it's going to, the killer application is going to be a story. It's not going to be a device as such. And And I don't think it's going to be one of the standard e-book special devices. I think it's going to be something like a PDA or a phone or a Nintendo DS. It's going to be something that people already have in their houses, that people already have in their pockets. So it's going to be a great story plus a great device that's accessible. And the game developers have recognized this and are talking to authors, including myself, about what the future is going to be.
What are you going to do? Are you going to write one of your crime novels with a little game?
No, it's going to be different because the audience for e-books is different from the audience for standard books. They're younger, they're funkier, they're...
So you're not telling me, are you, Nuri? I've noticed you're not actually answering this question, are you?
Right. I'm wriggling around,
rabbiting on, as we say.
Yes,
and you're not answering this because it's a big commercial secret, presumably.
Exactly.
Is that right?
All
right. Well, talking of commercial secrets and stuff like that, Mike Schatzkin, can you explain how the issue of rights management affects e-book publishing?
Well, rights management, called digital rights management, DRM, is a method or a variety of methods by which digital content is locked in some way so that it can't be passed around very readily. So it's either locked, it's usually locked to a particular device or a particular computer, and it can only be opened in one device or one computer. And the point to this from the publisher's point of view or from revenue generation point of view is to make it impossible for people to buy one copy and give it to 100 friends who then don't have to buy it themselves. And this, by the way, is not just about books. It's about music. It's about software. It's about any digital file. The problem is, of course, that when we buy books, we're used to being able to give it to our wife to read or give it to our friends to read. And this doesn't feel particularly friendly to the people who buy the books. And in addition, sometimes the DRM doesn't work for some reason or creates some sort of muddiness in the file. And so then you've got a whole customer service issue that comes along with the digital rights management. So it's a very tricky question. There are a lot of people. There's something else called social DRM, where essentially what you do, let's say, is watermark a person's name and credit card number onto the ebook, every page of the ebook that they bought. That would make them somewhat less likely to pass it around or post it on the internet. And that's another way of doing it. That doesn't actually lock up the file, but it certainly discourages the person who got the file from being casual about shifting it around. But that's what DRM is.
And what happens with a library, say? How does the library lend an e-book?
I don't know about everywhere in the world. The library lending of e-books in the U.S. is managed this way. The library can only lend the number of copies that it buys, and it can't at any simultaneous moment. So a library buys 5 copies of Sherman's book, and 5 people can borrow that copy from the library. But once 5 people have it, and while they have 5 people have it, the library is forbidden or inhibited from lending a 6th. So DRM, in the case of the library, is used that way. Now, the other thing that DRM does with the library is if the library lends you the book for 2 weeks, you will find that after you've had it for 2 weeks, it won't work anymore. Mm. So DRM is simply applied differentially to the library, to the way that it's applied to the individual consumer.
So you don't have to take it back, obviously. It just explodes in your little thing.
That's right.
Now, Sherman, what are the issues that writers have to deal with that might be different from their present arrangement with publishers to have their books available as e-books?
From a rights point of view, I guess it's all about trying to get those electronic rights. And I think Mike spoke at length on Tuesday about the difficulties that someone like an author might have in those negotiations, because often when you're having a book published, as he says, there's a one buyer. And, at this stage, most of us poor authors are handed a boilerplate contract with particular rights on it. And if you don't like it, well, do you really want your book published? So there's a sense that authors, whilst it's important they're aware of, like, trying to get hold of their electronic rights, often it's difficult. What do you do? You say, okay, if I want my book published, I have to give you my electronic rights. So I think maybe there has to be a little bit more give and take from a publisher's point of view. Maybe they have to understand that perhaps in the next decade or couple of decades that the ebook will become not just a peripheral part of the publishing process, but perhaps central, in which case they have to treat the author with perhaps more equity in terms of the ebook than they are with at the moment. But yeah, it's a negotiation because contracts have to be signed and authors need to try and get a handle on getting an upper hand.
Just in the last minute, I mean, there does seem to be a contradiction between what we think of the global publishing industry on the one hand and how territorial it is in terms of which books come out where and how easy it is to get books from wherever you are. Do you think that's going to be the same situation with ebooks, Mike?
It hasn't been so far. So far, the ebook has been one publisher, usually the originating publisher, usually a US or UK publisher, controls ebooks for the world. It's a little difficult to understand exactly how you'd manage ebooks. You could do it by the domain of the person ordering it, but I'm not sure how that'll shake out. I think in general, what we're going to see is less territorial control of the physical books. And that, in other words, we're moving toward a world where territorial control is going to be harder and harder to enforce, as it is already, compared to 10 years ago or 30 years ago or 50 years ago.
Well, thank you all for joining us today. Mike Schatzkin is a digital publishing consultant. He's the founder and CEO of the Idea Logical Company in New York. Sherman Young is the author of the forthcoming The Book is Dead, Long Live the Book, which is a University of New South Wales Press book, and it's available in September. And Nuri Vitacci, it's always a pleasure having you with us. He's from the Asia Literary Review. And this is The Book Show. Thank you, gentlemen. It was fantastic talking to you.
Thank you, Ramona. Thank you.
On ABC Radio National, I'm Ramona Kova. And, of course, you can find all the details on the web, all the stuff about everything we've been talking about and links, because we've had a revolution here too, abc.net.au/rn/bookshow. Thanks this week go to the producers of the program, Rhiannon Brown, Sarah Lestrange, Catherine Franey, Michael Sheriffs, and technical producer Martin Lawrence. On Monday's program, we hear from singer-songwriter and now debut novelist Willie Verlauten with his heartfelt tale, The Motel Life, about two brothers who skip town when they accidentally get involved in a hit and run. On Tuesday, we're speaking with John Tranter about the highly respected online poetry journal called Jacket. Before we go today, I want to mark the passing of our dear friend and colleague, Kate Bochner, who died this week at the age of 46 from breast cancer. You might have heard her book reviews on The Book Show, Wry and Pointed and Always Generous. She also presented and produced our sister program, Lingua Franca, for part of this year. But much of her work was of this unsung radio producer kind. Several major series for Radio National, including Rethinking Australia, Robert Desay's series about Australian public intellectuals, and The Great Travellers, also with Robert Desay, about travellers since ancient times. With Michael Cathcart, she produced the Australia Forum series, and she co-produced the Deakin Lecture broadcasts, both for the Big Ideas program. One of her recent book readings was the production of Romulus, My Father by Raymond Gaita, which was rebroadcast recently on our show. But her influence on the style and substance of many of the programs on Radio National, as well as her wisdom and endless capacity to nurture other program makers, was of inestimable value to all of us. Our thoughts go out to her husband, James Griffin, and to her children, Daniel and Stephanie. We'll all miss you, Kate. That's all from me, Ramona Koval, on ABC Radio National News Time shortly.
Listening to another ABC Radio National podcast. ABC Radio National, on air and online, with many of our programs available as podcasts or MP3 downloads. All the details at abc.net.au/rn/podcast.